Hello, this is Andy Bombeck, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program, or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to complete Mojo's review of the top Steely Dan songs. So today, I'm going to give you the top five Steely Dan songs, and then an interview with the icon Dion, and an article about the Butthole Surfers, and a classic album review of Frampton Comes Alive by, of course, Peter Frampton. Okay, for the last 2 weeks, I've been reviewing the 30 greatest Steely Dan songs, and coming in at number five, Ricky, Don't Lose That Number, from Pretzel Logic, 1974. Dan gets vulnerable and score their biggest U.S. single. A coincidence? Misanthropic Fagin stands down for this unrequited crush on writer Ricky Doncorme, wife of his Bard College professor. Inspiring a mix of longing, urgency, and even machismo. You don't want to call nobody else. Draped in seamless folds of samba pop. A luminous flapamba, something like a marimba, intro sets up a left-hand piano riff as close as this to Horace Silver's Song for My Father. Fagin thinks he filched it from Sergio Mendez, but the trade-off between tender verse and escalating chorus is entirely Dan's. And here's a little bit of that song, Ricky, Don't Lose That Number, from Steely Dan, from their album, Pretzel Logic. Top four Steely Dan song, Do It Again, from Can't Buy a Thrill, 1972. No point hitting the road. Jack, you keep coming back. Album one, track one, pulling your body one way, your mind the other. In seconds, Steely Dan announce a career of ambiguity. Skinsman Jim Hodder and Victor Feldman percolate an irresistible bossa nova, while Fagin's dark electric piano in G minor glowers with foreboding. His semi-desperate voice pitching scenarios of frontier revenge, cheated lover and gambling addict that show every man, Jack, doomed to repeat his mistakes. The wheel turning with Buddhist fatalism. On choral electric sitar, Denny Diaz sizzles. And here's that song, Do It Again, from Steely Dan, from Can't Buy a Thrill. Number 3, Kid Charlemagne, from The Royal Scam, 1975. The downfall of a psychedelic Walter White. The devil and the Dan are here in the details. Here, it's the kerosene kitchen clean rhyme, never heard in a century's worth of popular song, yet perfectly chosen to encapsulate and foreshadow the rise and fall of what Becker called an Owsley-esque figure, an outlaw acid chief of the 60s. Add in a groove that bubbles like a Bunsen-fired beaker, that rare falsetto flip from Fagan, and a slalom guitar solo from Larry Carlton. And you've got one for the ages. Here it is, Kid Charlemagne, from Steely Dan, from The Royal Scam.
Just by chance you crossed the diamond with the pearl. You turned it on the world. That's when you turn the world around. Did you feel like Jesus? Did you realize that you were a champion in their eyes? On the hill the stuff was laced with kerosene, but yours was kitchen clean. Everyone stopped to stare at your technical motor. Every apron had your number on the wall. You must have had it all. Go to LA on a dare and you go it alone.
Could you live forever?
Could you see the day? Could you feel your whole world fall apart and fade away?
Get it long. Get it long, Kid Charlemagne. Get it long, Kid Charlemagne.
And at number 2, the song Peg, from Asia, 1977. Talking to pianist Warren Bernhardt in 1993, Donald Fagen described Peg as a major blues, referencing the 50s ballads of Ray Charles and Bobby Blue Bland, but pointing out that he'd added some Amen gospel chords to the mix as well. Major blues is a pretty good description of Peg as a whole. A downer song turned bright, great, and radical. There are enough books out there that will tell you that Peg substitutes plagal cadences for each of the standard three chords of a 12-bar blues, and that the cadences don't resolve strongly on downbeats. But all that really comes down to is a major blues, where the song's harmony is at cross purposes with its downbeat structure. And Peg is a song that is all about cross purposes. Listen to that opening, bright, jaunty, layered, glossy, a complex jazz rock structure, passing itself off as casual FM groove. Then listen to those lyrics. I've seen your picture, your name in lights above it. This is your big debut. It's like a dream come true. It's a big day for someone, but not, you suspect, Peg herself. That's a complex person trying to pass themselves off as smooth and casual, and suddenly all that jauntiness starts to sound like false bohemian. Speaking to the Wall Street Journal in 2020, Pagan said that Peg takes place at a seedy photo shoot in L.A. in the 1950s. All of the lyrics are from the perspective of the jilted boyfriend, who is still hanging around with a starlet on the way up. This boyfriend is also that buoyant, insistent melody. He isn't going anywhere, and you're not going to get rid of him. As with all the best Steely Dan songs, no one telling the story here is reliable. Not the boyfriend, not Fagen, not the music that soundtracks the narrative. As Fagen says elsewhere in that WS interview, Walter Becker and I like creating the sensation of a story through word fragments that aren't too literal. And as with Akira Kuroshima's 1950 film, Rashomon, Peg is a shady tale told from different perspectives. Beyond Becker and Fagen's lyrics, beyond its bright, compact packaging, multiple dark interpretations are being given. You can hear it from the off in the slightly uneasy blend of Paul Griffin's Fender Rhodes and Don Grolick's clavinet, the serendipitously oily slaps of Chuck Rainey's bass, the dry sync generated melancholy hook of Tom Scott's Lyricon, different voices of slick unease. Most striking is that respect are Michael McDonald's backing vocal harmonies, a tight, echoing excess of sympathetic savity that feels almost claustrophobic, and Jay Graydon's rough-assed Polynesian-style ascending guitar solo, which brings what Fagen now refers to as a Stravinsky-like anarchy to the airless, closed-set order of the Peg narrative. But, as De La Soul proved, what remains is that melody, Tom Scott's jaunty Lyricon hook, and those words, those sinister words. The chorus as karmic curse. Peg, it will come back to you. And here's some of that song, Peg, from Steely Dan, from the album Asia. And Mojo Magazine's number one Steely Dan song, yeah, you guessed it, Reelin' in the Years, from Can't Buy a Thrill, 1972. Shortly after Can't Buy a Thrill was released, Denny Diaz, the guitarist, who'd once placed an ad in the Village Voice looking for a keyboard and bass player, and had it answered by Donald Fagen and Walter Becker, foretold something to a reporter. I may be a perfectionist, but this is the worst album we'll ever make. Of all their records, it may indeed be the group's most hurried, least focused. What with its three lead vocalist. But there's something elementarily satisfying about Steely Dan's first utterance that makes it a perfect entry point for new fans. Diaz said he stopped writing songs when he first heard Don and Walter's work, like hearing the Beatles with jazz chords. But even he was taken aback when the record he considered comparatively scrappy yielded two huge hit singles, both of which remain reliable crowd pleasers half a century later. In this case, at least, perhaps he was right to be surprised. For such an iconic song, Reelin' in the Years is a curious confection when you get up close. It opens with a 30-second guitar solo. The verse lyric is overcrowded, almost rap-like in its tumbling flow. Producer Gary Katz rated Fagen's ability to make it sound easy. I would dare anyone to sing a verse of Reelin' in the Years. The double chorus is laid over an unusual chord sequence. B minor, D, A, B, M, E minor 7, diminished, D minor. Its second half decorated with strikingly prominent guitar harmonies. After the second chorus section, there's another display of guitar fireworks. Another full verse and chorus follow, but then yet more soloing with a bluesy improvisation going into the fade-out. In all amounts to flamboyant demonstration of chops almost vulgar in comparison to future Steely Dan recordings. There's a breathlessness and urgency uncommon in their catalog. Bodhisattva is perhaps its nearest equivalent. They come ripping out of the traps and pelt the entire length of the track. Getting that opening solo right foxed the band's second guitarist, Jeff Skunk Baxter, but it was nailed by visiting New York buddy Elliot Randall, whom Baxter had invited to Village Recorders in L.A. to say hi to the guys, then offered a chance to try something over the intro. Randall plugged his 1963 Fender Stratocaster into an APEG SVT bass amp, not his chosen setup, but it worked, and peeled out a stinging solo, using the chorus melody as his starting point, which everybody instantly loved. Unfortunately, the engineer hadn't recorded it, so Randall did it again. That second take is the one you hear, subsequently nominated by Jimmy Page as his all-time favorite guitar solo, marking it 12 out of 10. A year or so later, Becker and Fagan told New York broadcaster Allison Steele, whose show on WNEW, The Nightbird, may have been a key inspiration for Fagan's The Nightfly, that this song started as a recorded jam, its lyric conjured later, which may be why the words feel jammed in, but that pushiness is relevant. In a 1974 article for Cream, writer Wayne Robbins mentioned that he'd known Becker and Fagan to nod to at Bard College, the upstate New York school they'd all attended. He judged, reeling in the years, the best song ever written about the pseudo-poetic, preppy hippie, assholism that dominated Bard and other joints of its kind. The lyric sees its narrator being baffled by his college girlfriend dumping him. After all the things we've done and seen, you find another man. The things you think are useless, I can't understand. Dan and Walter understood deluded hipsters. Fagan's youth occurred when pop was all Pat Boone and Tab Hunter, white bread chart fodder that held no appeal for him. So his musical cravings were salutated by jazz radio, and he didn't graduate to pop until things like Dylan's It's All Over Now, Baby Blue, and The Lovin' Spoonful, Do You Believe in Magic, caught his ear. Becker made a similar downstream journey via the blues. Their pop epiphanies coincided with their years at Bard. So, as everyone else was just getting pretentious at college, Don and Walter were emerging from their beatnik phase and starting to loosen up, a process that effectively became the recipe for Steely Dan, finding the sweet spot between cool and abandonment. We can and should do anything, but it has to be right. Pursuing that rightness saw them becoming more rarefied and subtle over time, but on Reelin' in the Years, they just lay it all out there. Some commentators have credited the song with kickstarting a new kind of musicality in American rock, as if it gave a new generation of players permission to blow. That may be overstating its impact, but it certainly set a tone for the sound that started filling FM airways. Luxury pop with an awareness of jazz. Joni Mitchell's Chord and Spark, Weather Report, and so on. Blowing a grittier East Coast current into the sound of the West Coast. Lyricism stripped with cynicism. In subsequent interviews, Becker and Fagan were sniffy about their early work, calling their first releases at best immature, at worst humiliating. The best compliment Fagan could muster for this song was dumb but effective. Becker went further, saying it's no fun, but they softened. Becker eventually noting to Musician Magazine in 1982 that Do It Again is a fucking good record. Reelin' in the Years is a good record. I'd agree with that, said Fagan. It was as self-congratulatory as they ever got. And here's a little bit of Mojo Magazine's number one Steely Dan song, Reelin' in the Years, from Can't Buy a Thrill. Bit of one of my all-time favorite songs, The Wanderer by Dion.
Run around, Sue. Oh, yeah, now I'm on top of guy. Never set her down. Pretty girls are where you know I can be found. Kiss me, go on here on the same. I held them in a squeal. They don't know my name. I'm a wanderer. You're a wanderer. I'm on top of the line, like a roam around. I'm
You've picked some tough voices and mean guitarists to collaborate with. Does that say something about your perspective on women? It's funny, when I was a kid, Paul Anka was singing, "Put Your Head on My Shoulder." I said, we got to start singing about women with some gravitas. So I started putting songs together like Donna, the Prima Donna, and Runaround Sue. Independent women. I'll tell you something. When you're in a room and a beautiful woman walks in with the kind of talent that's on this record, man, the atmosphere changes. You up your game. In the foreword to this album, Darlene Love says, when I sang He's a Rebel, I was singing about people like Dion. Well, when you're walking around in your own skin, you don't think of that stuff, but yeah, we were gangbusters. I was from the Bronx. I came out of a gang. We were like the rappers of the late 50s. Chuck Berry was writing about cars and schools, and I was singing, I Was Born to Cry. But I was so insecure when I got to the record company. They gave us songs like Teenager in Love to Sing. Born to Cry wasn't a stretch. Teenager in Love was a stretch. But no one back then sat you down and said, think about what you really want to do. No, they just kept telling you what to do. I suppose you at least had producer Tom Wilson at Columbia looking out for you. I was the first rock and roller signed to Columbia. Tom had great sensibilities. He asked me about Bob Dylan because I used to go to all his early sessions. He asked, what do you think if we put an electric band behind Dylan? I thought Dylan would blow a fuse, but Dylan went for it. Dylan was something to behold back then because it was like somebody let him out of a cage or something. He just exploded in there. It was unbelievable. I read somewhere that your style of singing was influenced by Jewish cantors. Is that true? In the Bronx, there were Jewish neighborhoods to the east and west of us. I was walking past the synagogue in Pelham Bay one day and heard this cantor. His name was Henry Rosenblatt. I walked in there because those were some earthral kinds of beautiful sounds. He brought me in the back and played me his father's records. His father was Yosel Rosenblatt, and he was in 1927 film The Jazz Singer as the Jewish Caruso. I went home and I wrote Born to Cry. The other influence I wanted to ask you about was Italian-American jazz and R&B singer Louis Prima. You know, if he didn't sing Italian songs, he would have been the first guy in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Louis Prima resonated with me because he's a rhythm singer. I'm a rhythm singer. Everything he sang would land in the right place. Singers who try to get fancy bore me to death. I tried it once in the early 70s, and when I hear those records now, I want to hide under a rug. Tell us something you've never told an interviewer before. I love talking to drunks. I love talking to men who are drinking too much and looking for a way out. I've been doing that for 55 years. They think they're weak, but they're so strong. They're like self-will run riot. I just want them to understand that. And here's an article about the punk band The Butthole Surfers, titled Their Satanic Majesty's Regrets. How did the scariest, most demonic band in rock and roll history come so close to mainstream success? And why did it ultimately elude them? Something to do with the uncompromising attitude, gut-wrenching live shows, and deliberately disturbing records? We were hurt people, punishing our audience with the worst music ever. The surviving Butthole Surfers confess to Andrew Perry. LSD was very much back in vogue in the UK when the Butthole Surfers rolled into London on February 26, 1988, for a now legendary gig at the University of London Union. As house music gripped the nation to a battle cry of Achid, many in the audience, also including a hardened biker contingent, were already orbiting on microdots. When these wild-eyed messiahs of Texan post-hardcore hit the stage, a strategy they universally came to regret as the night wore on. At the front, shirtless, in midwinter, the band's demonically cackling singer, Gibby Haynes, repeatedly bashed a fire cymbal, a hi-hat filled with blazing alcohol, sending flames up into the lighting rigs, while he mangled his sinister voicings via the dials on an FX gizmo. To the left, guitarist Paul Leary literally went cross-eyed as he summoned the gut-churning returned riff to Black Sabbath's Sweet Leaf, for which he and frilly-skirted bassist Jeff Pincus high-kicked in unison, with two drummers hammering away at the back as if heralding some tribal sacrifice. On any level of consciousness, it was fearsome stuff. The previous year, Blast First, the hip London label, which had already introduced Stateside, Noiseniks, Sonic Youth, and Big Black to British audiences, had licensed the Buttholes' third long player, Locust Abortion, Technician, scoring rave music press reviews and, amazingly, airplay from BBC Radio 1's John Peel. Its sacrilegious first track, Sweet Loaf, opened with a sickening twee father-son dialogue. "Daddy, what does regret mean?" asked the youngster, eventually prompting the paternal request. "If you see your mom this weekend, be sure and tell her, Satan, Satan, Satan." At ULU, the band's queasy fixations got a whole lot harder to stomach when the screen behind them showed an astonishingly slow-paced movie centered on a naked man's midriff. At a glacial pace, a pair of gloved hands set to work, making incisions around the genitals, and apparently preparing to remove them altogether. After a few minutes of this, your rider joined a stampede for the exit, alongside the Reed brothers from the Jesus and Mary chain, looking even peakier than usual. And yet, within 5 years, the Butthole Surfers were poised to be rewarded as revered pioneers of the new alternative rock, with a back catalog remastered and reissued on Matador from next month, as admired as it is unique. So how exactly did that happen, and where then did it all go wrong? Over Zoom, Paul Leary eyes Mojo ruefully. "The music industry humbled us eventually. Growing up in Dallas, Texas, Gibson Jerome Haynes was being groomed for a career in accountancy. In high school, he was sporty, a football quarterback, and at 6'6", a hoop-shooting ace in basketball. Needless to say, though, there was an attitude problem. While completing college at San Antonio's Trinity University, he was also clocking on as an auditor with Global Accountancy conglomerate Pete Marwick, later KPMG, on a $25,000 salary to help pay his tuition fees. But he soon got his marching orders when he accidentally left on a copier some gross medical photographs he was duplicating for the strange VD magazine he was collating with classmate Paul Leary. There's really no such thing as a high-earning accountant. Otherwise, I might have stuck in there, the 66-year-old Haynes laughs today, down the line from his home in Red Hook, New York. If I really had been so smart as you seem to think I was, I would have gone to graduate school and rode the college world forever. His father, Jerry Haynes, was a regional TV personality, hosting sports and cooking programs and playing kids' character, Mr. Peppermint, all of which doubtless imbued young Gibson with a belief that the entertainment industry might be both accessible and lucrative. Paul Leary Walthall had a more mundane upbringing, but circa 1978-79 identified the towering Haynes as a kindred spirit. As he swaggered around campus with his leather jacket and spiky hair, and the two connected to smoke pot and listen to punk records in their dorm rooms. At Trinity, a liberal arts college, Dibby was already staging parallel musical performances. Leary says he initially rebuffed Haynes' effort to recruit him, even though he could play the entirety of Grand Funk Railroad's double live album from 1970, note for note. It was hearing Out in the Gardener, a track from 1981's In a Car EP by Arizona country punks Meat Puppets on SST, that unlocked the door. It sounded like a train wreck, Leary tells Mojo from his home studio in Austin, Texas. There were a lot of drums, but there was no distinguishable beat, and the guitars and vocals went the same. It was like, hell, we could do that. They worked out some covers and self-compositions and debuted at a gallery opening in San Antonio for Haynes' own visual art. The band was pretty much a backdrop for Gibby, pulling out stuffed dummies and tearing things out of them, like toasters and Big Macs, says Leary. At one point, I looked down and saw Gibby rolling around on the floor with a meat patty hanging out of his mouth. The dummies were stuffed with newspaper, adds Haynes, and the gallery was 4 feet deep in crushed-up newspaper. The windows were open, and this springtime wind was blowing, sending tornadoes of it everywhere. It was fucking gorgeous. Suitably emboldened, Haynes and Leary persisted. Backed by a succession of fleeting bassists and drummers under a series of three-word appellations, which effortlessly dripped from Haynes' brain. Dick Gas 5, Ashtray Baby Heads, Abe Lincoln's Bush, until a friend introduced them on stage, referencing their song title, Butthole Surfer. A demo tape was recorded, a copy falling into the hands of one Jeffrey Coffey, a teenage hardcore fan from Fort Worth, Texas. Like, the state is run by Republican Baptist assholes, explains King Coffee today from his home, 10 minutes from Leary's in Austin. But the Buttholes were so different. Paul was all about 70s classic rock riffs, but he had to destroy the ridiculousness of arena rock and hardcore too, because that had become silly, dumb, and macho. A few months passed in which the Buttholes skipped town for California. and a bassist Chevy Nova. After penniless weeks in Los Angeles, begging for stage time, they drove to San Francisco, the Chevy barely making it over the Bay Bridge, and eventually sputtered to a halt in an industrial district. Without a clue to their whereabouts, they noticed a band loading into a venue, which turned out to be Punk Redoubt. Felisa Tool and Die, they pleaded to be allowed to play three songs, practically crying, laughs Leary, and their tears weren't wasted. As that evening, Jello Biafra from Dead Kennedys witnessed their malnourished chaos and signed them to his alternative Tentacles label on the spot. Biafra, the self-styled high priest of harmful matter, was immediately infatuated with us, says Haynes. But less happily, on their return to Texas, the rhythm section quit. Haynes and Leary found a rented house outside Austin and set about self-recording a debut EP, variously titled Brown Reason to Live and P.P. the Sailor, with anyone who'd participate. During that slow process, Coffee attended a show by his new heroes in Austin. The experience proved life-changing. Gibby was stripped to his boxers with clothes pins in his hair, drawing all over his body with marker pen, he recalls, and he was playing a saxophone really badly. I mean, who played sax at a hardcore show? Just the audacity of it. Afterwards, Coffee bounded backstage and was promptly enlisted, bringing his friend Teresa Nervosa Taylor with him. They served in a marching band together and duly pummeled away, both on their feet, inspired by Killing Joke's ritualistic wallop. Now able to complete their EP, its Biafra association helped the Hand gain traction nationally. Through the mid-80s, they toured relentlessly in a series of inadequate vehicles, one with a trench carved out of the cabin so two or three of them could sleep coffin-style together with Leary's pit bull, Mark Farner. Everywhere we went, says Coffee, the fact that Texans have a reputation as inbred and drooling freed us up to be as stupid as we wanted. Adds Leary's, we were hurt, fucked up people, punishing our audience with what we thought was the worst music ever. We'd get all the beer we could drink and gas money and move on to the next town. We relished being idiots. He pauses and adds deadly seriously, I never dreamt I'd one day turn into a normal human being. I thought we were committing suicide. Butthole Surfer's infamy as post-hardcore wildest Arifsis was secure. But not everything was to be taken at face value. Unlike their Texan forefathers, the 13th floor elevators, they didn't all drop acid before every show. We were taking a fuck ton of acid on stage, ponders Hades. I would admit to having actually taken the drug, but no, that wasn't the reality. Maybe the Grateful Dead did that stuff, but I can't imagine any drug, even weed, as a creative tool. According to Leary, the band subsisted on alcohol and marijuana, a forbidding an insular gang of weirdos pinballing from city to city, with Haynes as their linchpin. If nothing else, because his accounting background saw him entrusted with the band's day-to-day finances. The obvious flaws in this arrangement were exposed, but still not rectified subsequently. After a fracas in October 85 at Pandora's Music Box Festival in Rotterdam, which made front page headlines in Holland. Gibby got smashed on whiskey and started heaving chairs at the audience, Leary testifies. By the end, he was naked, fighting eight large Dutch bouncers who obviously hated us. Everybody left to go back to the hotel, and I was the only person responsible enough to rescue our equipment. So I was carrying bits and pieces, stopping in a park to hide stuff behind a bush, then get a second load. And I left all the gear stashed there overnight. The next morning, I went to retrieve it, and there was Gibby's overcoat. I reached inside the pocket, and it had $10,000 cash sitting in there. As the Butthole Surfers' notoriety increased, their fortunes improved, and they plowed most of their profits into their stage show, attracting plenty of attention from the authorities. Sometimes, says Leary, the alcohol from the fire cymbal would spill, so the whole floor was on fire. Then Gibby'd bring out a 12-gauge shotgun and blast that off. We had strobes so bright you could see the bones in your hand. It got to the point where the fire department would be there every night. They'd want to look at the shotgun, but then hand it right back to us. Nobody ever stopped us doing anything. Occasionally, they'd have bouncers with fire extinguishers side of stage, ready to put fires out. But as soon as they'd creep over, Gibby would douse them with alcohol and hold a lighter up to them, and they'd back off real quick. After washing up in San Francisco again and outstaying their welcome, they decided to settle somewhere else. New, threw a dart at a map and hit upon Athens, Georgia, home to alt-rock's biggest crossover act, REM. On arrival, the gentrifying college town proved too expensive, so they wound up in nearby Winterville. There, we bought an old work van from the Winterville Mobile Home Repair Service, says Haynes, but people would stop us all over the country asking if we could fix their toilets. Consequently, says Leary, they spray-painted over it, so it said Michael Stipe, despite the hype. I still want to suck on your big, long pipe. Stipe actually lived a block from our pot dealer, so we always enjoyed driving past. But we were too rude ever to speak to him. Okay, moving on. The classic album review this week is Frampton Comes Alive by Peter Frampton, 1976. Peter Frampton's live double, epitized post-Vietnam, escapist Sunshine Rock, with an estimated 16 million sales. It is second only to Bruce Springsteen's 1985 blockbuster as history's most successful live set. Recorded between March and November 1975, principally at Frampton's first headlining gig at Winterland in San Francisco, the album was summed up by Cameron Crowe in Rolling Stone as much more than a souvenir. It is a testimony to Peter Frampton in his natural habitat, following a template established by Kiss with their Alive. The album transformed a minor leaguer into a major player. The former member of British Rockers, The Herd, and Humble Pie had made three moderately successful albums. Now he enjoyed 10 weeks atop the Billboard chart. The 14-song selection, provides a fine cross-section of his albums and Humble Pie Days, jaunty Something's Happening, and insistent Show Me the Way, lay out his stall of echo-rich vocals, jazzy electric and sweet acoustic guitars, melodious harmonies, and Oh Baby lyrics. And here's a little bit of that song, Show Me the Way, from Peter Frampton off his album Frampton Comes Alive. The band rocks out on the likes of I Want to Go to the Sun, but it is the hysteria elicited by the hit anthem Baby, I Love Your Way and Toxbox laden Do You Feel Like We Do that proves the life-affirming nature of the Frampton sound. The album prompted an invitation to the White House from President Gerald Ford. We are not worthy. And unfortunately, once again, we're out of time. Please join me next week when I read articles from the most current May 2024 Mojo Magazine. Start off with an interview with Roxy Music guitarist Phil Manzanera, and then an article about unheard-of tapes and documents concerning Jimi Hendrix, and a classic album review of one of my favorites, The Ramones by The Ramones. Until then, this is Andy Bombeck for Mojo Music saying so long and keep rocking.
I'm swimming in a circle.